Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Healthy Skeptic Podcast. My name is Danny Roddy, and with me is Chris Kresser, health detective and creator of thehealthyskeptic.org, a blog challenging mainstream myths about nutrition and health. Chris, are you excited for our first episode?
I'm definitely excited. I've been looking forward to it for a long time. Yeah, can't wait. And why don't you tell everyone a little bit about who you are, Danny, and how we got together and what your, you know, what your interest in all this stuff is.
Basically, I got real sick in my early 20s, kind of roamed around, tried to figure out things for myself. I'm a self-proclaimed diet experimenter, but I'm going back to school for nutrition, and I'm just really passionate about the subject, and I'm really just trying to learn everything I can. And I stumbled upon your blog. I really respected it, your evidence-based approach. And when you mentioned that you were looking to do a podcast, I just jumped at the opportunity because I thought it sounded so fun. So to be a part of this is really an honor. I'm excited.
Yeah, and I'm glad you showed up because, as you know, I started the podcast a while back. I don't know, maybe several months ago, and I did an interview with Stefan Guyonnet, which was great. I really love that, and I did a podcast on fish oils and essential fatty acids. And then I think I was graduating and finishing school, and then I was studying for the licensing exam, and things just got really crazy, and I couldn't keep it up myself. And just had the idea that, hey, if I had somebody else helping me and, it was more interactive and that it would be easier to maintain. So that's the idea now. And I think we're going to try to shoot for twice a month to begin with. It seems maybe a little more doable than every week, at least for me right now. And the idea is to do a Q&A format. Pretty similar to Rob Wolf and Andy Dees' Paleo Solution. I know a lot of listeners listen to that one as well. So, you know, questions that people send in to you or me and our various blogs, things that I'm thinking about that I feel like might be of interest to listeners. But then I also want to have people come on the show, various folks from the paleo, health conscious blogosphere. We'll probably figure out some other fun stuff to do too. But there will be a separate category on my blog, thehealthyskeptic.org. It's going through a major design overhaul right now, which I'm excited about. It's going to be ready in a couple of weeks. And there's going to be a separate category called podcast. And I'm going to have a special way of submitting questions for the podcast there. But in the meantime, just go ahead and send them, use the contact form on that blog or on my professional site, chriskresser.com. We're keeping track of all your questions, so hopefully we'll get to them eventually.
We have a lot of questions.
Yeah, we could do this for a couple of years, I think, right now. But the good news is a lot of the questions are some of them overlap, and many of them are the same even. So, I'm sure we're going to get to a lot of it.
Cool. Do you want to get to our first question?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, our first question is from David from Australia. Okay, do you believe in the blood type diet? I'm currently seeing a naturopath, and they have established that I have type A blood, which means no dairy and no red meat. How does this stack up with the paleo diet, which is loaded with meat? Is there a negative impact for those with type A blood if they eat meat?
In a word, no. when I first heard about the blood type diet, it's been around for a while, right? I'm not even sure when the book came out. Do you know?
Yeah, I've been hearing it for years. It's been around.
It was around before I even got really, really serious about health and nutrition. But even then, I just remember thinking, that doesn't make any sense. humans have the same basic physiology, right? Regardless of blood type or race or what we've been eating or culture. And, scientists have been looking for these real significant physiological differences across races for a long time. I mean, think back to World War II and the Nazi crazy stuff the Nazi scientists were doing, but they've never found them, despite those, you know, extremely biased studies that were performed. So the idea that one diet is right for one blood type and another diet's right for another blood type just never really computed at all.
I have to laugh whenever any of my coworkers ask me about that question. It seems to be very easily digested for most people, that it seems to ring true for them for some reason. I'm not sure why.
I have a little theory about that. I mean, I think we all like to feel like we're special in some way and that we belong to a group and a tribe. And I say this kind of tongue in cheek, but it's actually also just from an evolutionary perspective true. You know, we're tribal animals and we want to feel like we belong. It's part of our evolutionary history. And I don't know. This is just my armchair psychology thing going here. But whatever the reasons for why it's appealing, let's take a closer look at why I think there's no basis to it from a scientific perspective. And for a really good written summary, it's the best I've seen debunking the blood type diet. You should check out this article on Don Matez's blog. Don writes Primal Wisdom. It's a fantastic blog.
Amazing blog.
Yeah, it's great. For those of you who don't know about it, it's Don Matez, donmatez.blogspot.com. He's another Chinese medicine guy turned paleo like me. And he just really takes it to the curb better than anybody I've ever seen. And he lays it out in four sections, and we'll just follow that template because I think it's a good logical way of thinking about it. So the first claim that the blood type diet makes is that as we evolved, we adapted to different foods, right? And that this adaptation resulted in the ABO blood groups. And the second part of that is that each of these different blood types is adapted to a different type of diet and food. Does that make sense?
Okay.
So, well, whether it makes sense or not, but you follow what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah.
So claim number two is that people of different blood types have different antibodies in their blood, and that because of this, each blood type is susceptible to different diseases. All right?
Okay.
And then claim number three and four kind of go together, which is that foods contain lectins that are very close in molecular structure to the various blood group antigens. And that, of course, then eating the wrong lectins would cause agglutination or clumping of blood and therefore disease.
Is he making the claim that all disease is autoimmune?
That's an interesting way of looking at it. I wouldn't say that, because he's saying that we're reacting to the lectins in okay. food. So that's food being exogenous. But in the sense that these lectins are, maybe passing through the gut.
Okay.
I don't know. I hadn't thought about it that way. But so let's take a look at the first claim. That typo, so Diadamo, is that how you pronounce his name? I never knew.
I've heard it pronounced like that.
Yeah. So Diadamo, he claims that that type O is the first blood type. And this is really where the problems start, because molecular biologists had determined that actually type A was the first blood type 4 or 5 years before he published his book. So, making an error that basic about the evolution of blood types really, to me, casts some serious doubt on the credibility of a book that bases its entire argument on the importance of blood types, right?
I would agree.
Yeah. So, and it should be obvious that type A and type B precede type O, because O contains antibodies to both A and B blood types. So this means that type O had to emerge later in an environment where type A and B antigens were already present. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that takes care of that. The second part of the first claim is that different blood types evolved as a result of different diets. So I think the idea is that A, standard for for agriculture, conveniently, type A's evolved when humans switched to agriculture, and those people who switched to agriculture evolved a type A blood type, and that type B evolved in response to humans starting to consume dairy. So this idea implies that ABO blood types are unique to humans, but they're not. We actually see ABO blood types in gorillas, orangutans, gibbons, baboons, and a whole bunch of primates. And we see that these blood types actually cross the various species. For example, you know, there are primates with type A, there are primates with type B, type O, etc. And we know that primates have not changed their diet, you know, significantly in millions of years. I don't know any monkeys that are practicing agriculture or cultivating cereal grains, and I've never seen any gorillas herding cows and milking them for dairy, you know, for milk.
You just haven't looked hard enough.
I guess not. So it seems clear then from that that type A didn't evolve as an adaptation to agriculture, and that type B didn't evolve as an adaptation to dairy. Otherwise, we wouldn't see those types in primates that don't practice agriculture or animal husbandry. Okay, so that's my response to the first claim. The second claim is that because each blood type has different antibodies, they're susceptible to different diseases. So, for example, he claims type O's get more ulcers than type A's, and he claims this is because type O's produce more stomach acid. But apparently he missed the memo that ulcers are caused primarily not by excess stomach acid, but by the bacterium H. pylori. The guy who discovered that actually won a Nobel Prize in medicine for that discovery.
Which, by the way, your posts on GERD are just incredible. Very good. If our listeners haven't checked those out, definitely check them out.
Yeah, thanks. That's such an interesting story, because everyone thinks that ulcers and GERD are caused by too much stomach acid, and, you know, of course, the acid suppressing drugs being the treatment of choice for that. But excess stomach acid is actually a really rare condition clinically. And, you know, getting back to how this relates to blood types, type O's do have a higher risk of gastrointestinal cancer than type A's, but that's got nothing to do with stomach acid. Turns out that H. pylori, the bacterium, can more effectively take root in the gut of type O's, because H. pylori has a protein structure that's so similar to the type O host proteins that it confuses the immune system. So basically, H. pylori is somewhat invisible to the type O immune system. And then H. pylori, of course, being the bacterium that causes ulcers. So that's why type O's have more ulcers. It's got nothing to do with excess stomach acid. And in fact, one of the things that H. pylori does to survive in the human host is to suppress stomach acid. So, you know, I talked about that in the series. So, whereas type A's, who have lower rates of GI cancer, they more easily recognize H. pylori as a foreign invader, which makes, you know, them more resistant to being infected by it, and it makes them have fewer stomach ulcers. So, that's the second claim. Shall we move on?
We shall.
Third claim. And I'm going to just kind of put the third and fourth together, because I think they go together. It's that lectins selectively cause agglutination or clumping of the blood and disease in different blood types. So the idea there is that, like, people with type B blood should avoid chicken because it contains lectins that will agglutinate their blood, whereas chicken won't, you know, the lectins in chicken won't agglutinate blood of other types. So what I can say about this is that there's just no evidence for it at all. If you look at the published data, they indicate that any individual lectin will affect all the blood types in essentially the same way. So, you know, the burden of proof is on Diadamo to show that lectins affect different blood types in different ways, and I've never seen anything in the scientific literature to suggest that. And some of the studies that he cites in his book that he is claiming prove that don't prove that. And Don does a really good job of picking one of those studies apart. So if you want to know more about that, go check out Don's blog. I think it's called A Primal Perspective on the Blood Type Diet, the article or something. It's great. So hopefully that should be enough to put that one to rest.
The blood type diet is bogus.
That's the verdict.
Okay, so David has a second question that has nothing to do with the blood type diet. So here we go. My naturopath performs a HEMA review every 6 weeks to monitor my blood profile. He has noticed that my red blood cells are different sizes, which indicates an iron deficiency. I have been taking iron supplements now for 6 months, but my red blood cell profile hasn't changed. I'm aware that it can take 3 months for liver to produce new red blood cells. I have taken it on myself to get a serum ferritin test for peace of mind. It came back at 133. I have read that the high ferritin levels lead to oxidative stress and increased risk of heart attack. So my question is, if my serum ferritin is 133, then I'm absorbing iron for it to be stored. Okay, but why is my blood profile still showing lack of iron due to different shaped red blood cells? If I'm absorbing through diet supplements, then why does my body decide to store it instead of putting it to use? Thanks and good luck with the podcast. Regards, David.
Okay.
This is a long one.
Yeah, and I was hesitant to take it on. As you know, we talked about whether I was going to try to tackle this. The thing about oxygen deliverability and anemia issues, they're so complex. It's so tricky sometimes to figure them out, and there's so many factors that can affect all of the markers that are involved in oxygen deliverability, because that's what we're talking about here. Excuse me. You know, there's two ways that we produce energy in the cell. I mean, we get glucose and oxygen are required for energy production in the cell. So we got to have a steady supply of oxygen. We got to have a steady supply of glucose. That's why looking at these markers can be pretty important in terms of determining overall health. I'm unclear on a lot of things in David's question. I'm not sure what a HemaView is. I'm just going to kind of interpret his question the way the way I think he means it, and you know, hopefully that answers his question. If it doesn't, we'll have a little interesting discussion about what I want to talk about in terms of anemia and oxygen deliverability. So I think what he's referring to is a marker called RDW, red blood cell distribution width. So if our red blood cells develop properly, they should be relatively uniform in size. And if that just helps them function better in the body, if they're all the same size or roughly the same size. If they don't develop properly because of iron deficiency or other causes, then they'll vary a lot in size. And that variation is the red blood cell distribution width, or RDW. So if we see RDW high on a lab panel, it's, you know, iron deficiency is one of the first things we'd think about. He didn't mention what his iron level is or total iron binding capacity, which are the, you know, two other markers I'd want to look at. He didn't mention what his hemoglobin, hematocrit, or red blood cell levels were, which I would also want to look at. Just, you know, to complete the whole picture.
Those other markers have a lot to do with B vitamins, correct?
Yeah, B vitamins are involved. But essentially what all of those markers are measuring is how is oxygen being delivered to the cells.
Okay.
And we're talking, you know, the pathology that we're talking about is anemia. So like if hemoglobin, hematocrit, and red blood cells are low and iron is low, you've got an iron deficiency anemia. And there's lots of different kinds of anemias, and we could have like 5 podcasts talking about them, but I don't want to do that because it gets confusing. So David is confused because he tested his ferritin and it was higher than normal instead of low. And ferritin's the storage form of iron. So he was expecting it, I'm sure, as you know, to be low because he had what he said was iron deficiency. So, you know, the problem is that ferritin is also something called an acute phase reactant. And this is a protein that's involved in an inflammatory response, C-reactive protein, or CRP, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard of, is another acute phase reactant. And elevated ferritin, like CRP, can be a result of systemic inflammation independently of iron status. So it's possible that what's happening is that his iron is still low as indicated by the RDW, but ferritin is high, not because that there's too much iron being stored, but because of some inflammatory process in the body. Another possibility is maybe something called the anemia of chronic disease or anemia of inflammation, and that presents with low iron levels and normal or high ferritin. And that can happen in chronic infection or chronic immune activation or chronic inflammatory conditions like autoimmune disease, for example. And what happens there is in response to the inflammatory cytokines that are being produced, the liver produces increased amounts of something called hepcidin, which is a peptide hormone. And then hepcidin in turn stops ferritin from releasing iron stores. So this reduces, you know, iron, serum iron levels, but the ferritin or the storage form of iron will still be high. But if he doesn't have any other symptoms, I wouldn't necessarily suspect that. And again, it's just really hard to know without those other markers what's happening here.
Dr. Karazian, if I remember correctly, says that anemia is a deal breaker, which was pretty interesting. And he never, in his book, Why Do I Still Have Thyroid Symptoms, he never really explains what to do about it, perhaps because it's so complex.
Yeah, I mean, it is a deal breaker. The first two things I look at on a lab panel are oxygen deliverability and blood sugar, because if those aren't, you know, we just said glucose and oxygen required for cellular energy production, you know, ATP, that's the fundamental, you know, that's the fuel that we run on. If you're not getting a steady supply of oxygen and glucose into your cells, nothing else is going to work right. So those are definitely the two deal breakers. And I wish there was some way to just to say this is how you resolve anemia. But the thing that a lot of people don't fully understand is that anemia is such a broad, it's like saying inflammation, or maybe even more general than that. You have to find out what the cause of the anemia is. You've got iron deficiency anemia. You've got also folate and B12 deficient anemia. And so, you know, if you don't know what the cause is, then you don't really have a good hope of treating it properly. So, David might want to get CRP tested just to, if he is having other symptoms, you know, inflammatory symptoms, just to see what's happening there. He also might want to try a different type of iron. The ionic forms that are of iron that are in most supplements are not well absorbed, and they're made from some pretty dodgy materials. There's another form called heme iron polypeptide, which is a lot better absorbed and tolerated. The brand in the U.S. is called Proferrin, I think. I'm not sure what it would be in Australia, but I would expect iron levels to come up after several months. Sounds like he's been at it for a while. But the other issue, you know, is that he's not eating any red meat, I think, because of this blood type diet that says he's type A. So eating red meat is also a good way to increase your iron levels.
I didn't even put that together.
Yeah. So get off the blood type diet, David.
Okay, good advice. Okay, let's go to our second question. This one is from Elena. I'm not sure where she is. People, please send your location in with your question. Dear Chris, I have PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, and from last year I'm trying to eat healthy with the Zone because I've read that the origin of PCOS is insulin resistance. I'm trying to conceive and have added to my regimen R-lipoic acid or alpha-lipoic acid, as I read it is good to control blood sugar. Do you know if alpha-lipoic acid is bad for the fetus once I get pregnant? Thank you so much, and sorry for my bad English. I would love to find information about PCOS on your blog. Best regards, Elena.
Yeah, that's definitely a good topic. Maybe a series at some point, or a podcast more devoted to that, or, you know, something. I think it's good. A lot of people wonder about it. But it's true that PCOS definitely connected to insulin resistance. And insulin resistance in women in particular tends to lead to higher testosterone levels. It upregulates an enzyme that converts estrogen into testosterone. So, and high testosterone in particular is what, you know, causes PCOS. So that's the link there. I'm pretty reluctant to use much of anything during pregnancy in terms of supplementation. I don't think there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of things haven't really been studied. There's a lot we still don't fully understand about how pregnancy works and how the changes in the body that occur. So I would be way more likely to suggest a fairly, you know, a high fat, low carb diet to control the blood sugar and to improve insulin sensitivity. And I would probably couple that with some high intensity strength training, which has a really good, you know, big effect on insulin sensitivity and improving glucose tolerance. And I would have her measure her blood sugar with a glucometer to determine what her carbohydrate tolerance is. So that's a device that a lot of diabetics use. You just prick your finger and put a little drop of blood on a strip, goes into the machine and tells you what your blood sugar is. And the way that you use that to test your carbohydrate tolerance is you eat a meal and then you wait an hour, or you take your blood sugar right before you eat the meal, and then you wait an hour and you take it an hour later, and then you take it 2 hours later. And the deal is you don't want your blood sugar going above 140 after 1 hour, and you don't want it above 120 after 2 hours. And if it's going above that, then you're eating more carbohydrate than you can tolerate in general. So I would, you know, the lipoic acid can be helpful, you know, now, but during pregnancy, I wouldn't do it. I would just try to get a better handle on it before pregnancy with the glucometer and the strength training and the high fat paleo type of diet, and then let the body do the rest.
Agreed. Food seems to be a better medicine.
Especially during pregnancy. I don't think there's any time where that's more true than pregnancy.
Agreed. Okay, let's get to our third question from Peter. Hi, Chris. I love both your blogs, and I've undertaken reading through everything you've written, with special attention to your post on statins and cardiovascular disease, in order to help my dad, who has CVD. He had a heart attack about 14 years ago, after which he underwent a bypass surgery and was put on a number of meds, including statins. After doing a lot of research, I'm quite certain that the statins are completely unnecessary, if not detrimental, considering that I don't believe high cholesterol is a factor in his illness. Besides the immune difficulty, the immense difficulty in convincing him to go against the advice of his doctor, I also face another challenge in getting him off them. About a year ago, he received a stent to open up one of his arteries. I've seen a number of studies that seem to show that statins confer special benefits to CVD patients with stents. The benefits seem to come not from cholesterol lowering, but from the anti-inflammatory effects. So my question is, would it still be wise to try to get him off statins given the fact that he falls into the apparently special class of CVD patients? My hunch is that the same anti-inflammatory effects could be achieved through exercise and diet, but if I can't be sure he'll pursue those things, are the statins better than nothing? Thanks so much for the work you're doing.
That's a good question, and it's one that comes up quite a bit. You know, in general, I think I'd start by saying I never tell anybody to stop taking a drug. I mean, there's a legal issue there for me because I'm not a medical doctor. It's not within my scope of practice to do that. But there's another more general issue, which is I think it's really important for people to make decisions for themselves and to understand why they're making those decisions. And this is where it gets difficult with things like statins and other drugs that can have, you know, pretty serious side effects. The whole cultural paradigm is set up to make people believe that these drugs are almost miraculous in their ability to protect against heart disease. You know, it's nobody really, very few people in the conventional wisdom or lack of wisdom even question that, from, you know, primary care doctors to cardiologists to the media to Joe Schmo on the street. So anyways, that's just a little caveat. Like I think it's the challenge we all face with our family and friends is one of education primarily. Like how do we help them to make decisions that are in their best interest without trying to make those decisions for them ourselves? And that's tricky. So I empathize with anybody who's in that position. I've been there myself many times. It is true that statins have been shown to reduce the risk of cardiovascular events and mortality in people with stents. There's a very small percentage of people that statins are demonstrated to benefit, and this is one of them. It's basically men with pre-existing heart disease. The other 95% of the population is not so much. But that 5%, they do have some benefit. But of course... Go ahead.
Is that because of the anti-inflammatory effects on CRP?
CRP, that's controversial. I mean, what you see in studies is that as CRP goes down, you don't necessarily see a reduction in CVD events. I think it's almost certain that the effects of statins in those cases are because of their are anti-inflammatory. They also increase endothelial nitric oxide, which is a really important antioxidant in the epithelium of the arteries. It makes has pretty profound effects on blood flow, improving blood flow. So we don't really know, frankly, why they're working. Just like we don't fully understand all of their side effects, which are pretty serious.
Like Alzheimer's, memory loss.
Some real stuff that you really don't want happening to you as you get older. I mean, the number one is muscle pain and fatigue. And there's a doctor named Beatrice Golam. I'd love to meet her. She's at Berkeley. She's not far away. She's in my neighborhood somewhere. But she's done amazing research on statin side effects, and she's just an independent observer. She's got no agenda other than to figure out what these drugs are doing. And she's found that irreversible muscle pain and fatigue is the main side effect of statins. That's scary. I know tons of people who have muscle aches and pain when they take statins, and unfortunately sometimes that's actually irreversible. Cognitive impairment, you mentioned Alzheimer's, a lot of studies in the literature lately linking statins to Alzheimer's. Decreased libido and sexual dysfunction, depression, mood instability. Why would they do that? Well, cholesterol plays a really important role in the brain. And if you just arbitrarily lower cholesterol across the board, you're going to have these systemic effects. And, I've said this before on my blog, drugs don't have side effects. They just have effects because, they're affecting the whole system globally. So even though one of the effects might be something desirable, there's bound to be several other effects that are not desirable. And there's no way to stop that with the drug unless it's ultra, ultra, ultra specific, which we're just not really capable of doing yet. And that's not how the body works anyways, because there are proteins and genes that are related to several functions just for the one protein. So if you screw with that one protein, you're going to screw with all of the functions it's associated with. We're not able to just turn off one aspect of its function. So, the decision about whether to take drugs, there's always two important things for me as a practitioner and, as a patient consumer. It's a cost-benefit analysis first, the potential benefits I'm going to get from this drug outweigh the potential costs, okay? Or is it the other way around? And then the second question is, even if the benefits outweigh the cost, could I achieve the same result in another way? And that's the question. I think that's the main question here. And he alluded to it in his question. It would be great if we had a study comparing statin use with an anti-inflammatory paleo diet, but I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. I don't think we should wait around for that. I suspect if we did, the dietary approach would be equal to or greater than the statin effects without any of the side effects, except, people feeling better and sleeping better and, having more energy. But the reason I feel that way is because it's addressing the problem at the source. That heart disease is an inflammatory condition. It's caused by inflammation and oxidative damage, not high cholesterol. And so it obviously makes sense to, in the treatment of heart disease, to focus on reducing inflammation. And of course, you can take a drug that does that, but why not just stop eating the things that are causing the inflammation in the first place? So what am I talking about? It's, you know, the same old things I'm always talking about. not eating industrial seed oils, which are really high in omega-6, balancing the omega-6 to 3 ratio. If I had a stent and I had heart disease, I would be, you know, basically avoiding those with to the fullest extent possible. I'd try to get my omega-6 down to like 2% of calories, which is really, really hard. I mean, even if you're hardcore with this kind of diet, it's hard. It's hard to get it down that. But if I had a stent, I'd do that.
We're talking about cooking pretty much every single meal yourself.
We're talking about very little restaurant food. I know. Yeah. I know this is going to sound so.
Militant.
Militant, overzealous, dogmatic, fundamentalist. I'll throw in my caveat after this. But let me just say, yeah, it means eating at home a lot. And it means when you do go out you eat out, you're eating things that aren't liable to be cooked in oil. Because you can bet they're not using butter or coconut oil to cook, you know, stir fry your veggies in the restaurant. Sorry, my phone's ringing over there. I don't know how to turn that one off. So you're just going to have to listen to that. So it also means, you know, that the handful of walnuts every day, that's out. Walnuts are really high in omega-6, just 100 grams a day.
Would you agree nuts are overrated in general?
Nuts are totally overrated. I mean, they're convenient snacks. They're tasty, and the whole nut fetish in the paleo community is got to go. I mean, that's causing a lot of problems. Getting back to the walnut example, if you eat just 100 grams a day, which is not that much, that's like a big 3 ounces, right? In a week, you're getting 270 grams of omega-6. You're supposed to be getting like less than, you know, about 4.5. If you have a 2,000 calorie diet, you want to keep it to about 4.5 grams a day, which is very little. So just to give you an idea, in order to have the equal amount of omega-3 and omega-6, which is what we should have for optimal health, you'd have to eat 34 pounds of salmon in a week just to balance out that ratio, just with a handful of walnuts. And then you got chicken skin, particularly like a thigh or a leg with chicken skin, very high in omega-6, unfortunately. I'm just pointing out the less obvious things. I mean, of course, we have like all the packaged and processed foods and, you know, things that are loaded with industrial seed oils. That's obviously out. But also, you got to reduce the nuts. You got to reduce the poultry, because poultry is high in omega-6 often, at least the skin and the fat and the darker meat. And then you got to be eating salmon or if cold water fatty fish like mackerel or herring or sardines, probably 6 ounces 2 to 3 times a week. Then we want to be reducing carbohydrates and replacing those with saturated fats. That give you 3 beneficial effects. It'll increase the HDL, it'll decrease the triglycerides, and it'll decrease levels of small dense LDL, which is the type of LDL that's associated with heart disease. I'm going to get a sip of water here. Go ahead and answer your question.
It sounds like Peter is arguing with family about this stuff is a non-winning situation. No matter any health ailment my family has, they're very reluctant to take any information from me. Not that I'm a doctor or anything, but just if I'm suggesting anything that they look into, it's... And Rob has talked about this on his show. It's just a non-win scenario. I don't know what it is about family, but have you experienced that at all, Chris?
Well, didn't Jesus say no man's a prophet in his own town? Yeah, I mean, he had it right. It's true. I have to say I'm pretty fortunate because my parents are totally down with all this stuff now. It took a while. But my dad had a scare. You know, he went in, he had one of those scans of his carotid artery, and the doctor read him the Riot Act and told him he better, you know, start eating lots of brown rice and broccoli with no fat and, you know, Weight Watchers meals and things like that. And he, you know, he obviously knew what I was up to and had read several of my articles, and he called me up and we switched him over to, he's not on a hardcore paleo diet, but he's pretty close. He doesn't eat any grains. He, you know, it's a high fat, moderate protein, pretty low carb diet. And his numbers have just gone completely normal. And, you know, even according to the conventional view, and his doctor is just flabbergasted and she doesn't know what to make of him. You know, like she asks him what he's eating and she just like slaps her forehead and says, I don't understand, but
he's, you know, obviously an anomaly.
Right. Exactly. but yeah, it's really hard to work with family on this stuff in general. And I think the best you can do is just give them information and just sort of throw it, you know, let it go after you pass it on. It's like we can't control people. Anyone who's tried to knows how that turns out. It's one of the fastest ways you can increase your suffering is try to control somebody else, especially a family member or a partner. But, you know, getting back to a few things to do if there's interest there. I mean, in addition to what we've already talked about, the eliminating the seed oils, getting enough omega-3, reducing carbs and replacing with saturated fat. I also want to make sure fat-soluble vitamins are there, vitamin D and particularly K2, which a lot of people outside of the sort of nerds like us that read health blogs all the time don't have any clue about. K2 is a really important fat-soluble vitamin. It regulates calcium metabolism, so that means it makes sure calcium gets into the hard tissues or the heart, you know, the bones and the teeth where it belongs, and stays out of the soft tissues like the arteries where it doesn't belong. And there's a lot of research now suggesting that K2 deficiency is pretty widespread and is probably a really significant factor in heart disease. So that K2 is only really found in the MK4 form, which is the form that, you know, has been shown to have all these benefits in grass-fed dairy and goose liver. I don't know about you, but I think a lot of people aren't eating goose liver. grass-fed dairy is more common, but still not that common. So it kind of explains why a lot of people aren't getting enough of it. There is a form of K2 called MK7 that's in natto and other fermented plant foods, but we don't really know if it has the same effects as MK4 that's in grass-fed dairy and goose liver, and even some studies have suggested that it doesn't. So then there's, of course, stress management and, you know, high-intensity strength training, getting a bit of exercise every day, all the kind of basic stuff. But honestly, if somebody won't do that, it's possible that a statin does make sense, even if it's just a few percent, you know, absolute reduction in risk for mortality. I don't know. It's a really hard question. I don't know.
Unless Peter was like cooking for his dad all the time, like in going to, I think Trader Joe's carries grass-fed cheeses,
yeah,
and raw dairy. And you'd probably have to search around if he was going for like raw milk or anything. But yeah, I guess we'd have to ask more questions about the involvement of Peter's treatment with his dad, or if he's just kind of giving him info or not. But all great answers.
Yeah, and definitely, I mean, of course, I have a whole special report on heart disease. I'm sure Peter knows this because this sounds like he's read a lot of it. But there's some videos there. There's one set of videos called "I Have High Cholesterol and I Don't Care."
That one was good. I like that one.
That explains the whole, that kind of debunks the whole idea that eating saturated fat causes heart disease. And, you know, so that's a good one to start with for the general philosophy. But I also have a set of videos called The Truth About Statins. So that could be, I find the videos they're pretty accessible, you know, for most, a lot of people won't read like a special report with 9 articles with 422 scientific, you know, references, but their eyes just start to glaze over. But a lot of people will watch a 10-minute video. So that's
And you break it down really, really well, especially the high cholesterol one. I really dig that one.
Yeah, I try to make it easy to understand for people because I think it's important. So good luck, Peter. Let us know how it turns out. Let us know if we can help in any other way.
Ditto. Okay, let's go to Marley. She has a question about beef liver. Hi, Chris. I'm a big fan of lamb and beef liver, and I've been eating it regularly for a while. I read something online about getting vitamin A toxicity from eating too much. Any idea what a safe amount to consume per week would be, and any benefits from eating it raw compared to cooked? Thanks for all the good info, Marley.
Ooh, raw beef liver. First of all, I'm totally jealous of Marley that she loves beef and lamb liver. I mean, there's no better superfood on the planet than liver. But here's my really frank admission that I cannot stand liver.
Have you ever put marjoram on it? I got
marjoram?
This tip from
margarine.
Margarine and beef liver.
I've put everything you can possibly imagine on it. I've cooked it in 15 different ways. I've resorted to cutting it up raw into tiny little pill size chunks and freezing those and then swallowing those chunks. I mean, it's a character deficiency. What can I say? I can't stand it. It makes me literally want to barf when I eat it. I think it has a lot to do with not eating it growing up too. I know a lot of people who love liver, they ate it growing up, and it seems to be an acquired taste. But anyways, that's my little thing that you can know about me now, even though I go around telling everyone to eat liver, and I still will, because it's amazing. So anyhow, this is a good question too. I'm glad it came up. It was inevitable it came up because it comes up all the time. And let's tackle it. It's true that very high doses of vitamin A can be toxic. One of the primary concerns is that it increases the risk of osteoporosis. And this has been shown to happen at not even super high doses, at just, you know, kind of moderately high doses. But here's a really important thing about that that rarely comes up in the discussion. High doses of A are only harmful in the presence of vitamin D deficiency. So this is huge. It's not an excess of A that causes problems, but an imbalance between A and D, kind of like the omega 6 and 3 ratio, right? It's not, you know, what we know is that we have to have an equal amount or roughly equal amount of those. It's not that omega 6 is necessarily bad in any amount. It's just that if it exceeds the amount of omega 3 by a significant margin, then we've got problems. So all of the fat soluble vitamins A, D, K, and E exist in a synergistic relationship, and there are a lot of studies that show that vitamin D reduces the toxicity of A and vice versa. And that even, you know, the other fat soluble vitamins K and E also play a role in the toxicity of both A and D. So one study that comes to mind showed that supplementing with vitamin D pretty dramatically increases the amount of A that's needed to cause toxicity. So for like a hypothetical 150, 160 pound person, I think supplementing with vitamin D raised the toxicity threshold to above 200,000 units of vitamin A a day, which basically means you'd have to eat more than 200,000 IU of A to experience toxicity.
And that's a ton.
Put that in perspective, yeah. 3 ounces of beef liver is 27,000 IU. So, you know, if you can choke down 30 ounces of beef liver in a day, more power to you, but probably shouldn't do that. 3 ounces, you know, a couple times a week might be a better target. But there was another study, an animal study on turkeys. I haven't read that many studies about turkeys, but these poor turkeys were split into three groups, and one group was fed high vitamin A only, and another group was fed high vitamin D only, and then the third group was fed high amounts of both vitamin A and D. And in the vitamin A only and the vitamin D only groups, they both develop pretty serious diseases, all the diseases you would expect from toxicity of each of those vitamins. But guess what? The turkeys that were fed high doses of both A and D did not develop any of the toxicity symptoms of A and D. So what this suggests is that vitamin A can only have toxic effects against the backdrop of vitamin D deficiency. So I think this is really important and that people should know about this. I mean, has this come up? Have you come across this idea that vitamin A is toxic?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm in my own personal experience with all my experimenting, I know mega dosing anything usually led to more problems. So I guess in like a food context, if you're eating tons of liver, the potential for a vitamin D deficiency seems pretty high.
Yeah, and vitamin D, a lot of people are deficient in it. I think 50% of Americans was the last statistic that I saw. And I can tell you, just in my private practice, I'd say that number is at least 50%. And my patient base is like more health conscious than average. So way more than average. So I think that number is probably higher. But you know, if we keep this, if people were eating all of the foods that were part of our evolutionary template, which contained vitamin D, and if people were getting exercise and getting outside and getting exposed to sunlight, you know, this question wouldn't really come up so much because it wouldn't be as easy to get out of balance with the A and D ratio. So let's get back to her question of how much, you know, vitamin A can you eat or take, or how much liver can you eat? Considering that I think a quarter of Americans consume less than half the RDA of vitamin A, I think vitamin A deficiency is probably a bigger problem for most people than excess. And considering its important role in pretty much every system of the body, and considering that A is not toxic with adequate levels of D, I think aiming for a dose of, you know, somewhere between 10,000 and 20,000 IU per day, or, you know, extending that over a week is a good idea. 6 ounces of beef liver would get you about 50,000 IU. So if you did that like twice a week, and if you're taking maybe some cod liver oil in small doses every day throughout the week, that would probably be a good amount, or maybe 3 ounces of beef liver twice a week plus cod liver oil. Just make sure that your D levels are sufficient. They should be at you know, somewhere between 35 and 40. You'll benefit tremendously from the liver. So don't let that idea that it's toxic scare you away.
Agreed. Superfood. Okay, let's get to our last question. This one's going to be from Peter. I have tried cutting back on carbs several times, but when I do, I get insomnia and feel uptight in general. I have not read about this in any low-carb book or blog and was wondering if you had any explanation for it and any ideas as to what steps I could take to prevent this from happening.
So this is an interesting question. I think this has come up once or twice before, but I'm going to try to answer it, but I'm just speculating here. I really would need more information to make better sense of it. The first question I would have is he cutting back from the standard American diet amount of carbs? You know, like from most people eat about 200 to 300 grams a day of carbohydrate in Western societies like the US. Or is he cutting back from, you know, a moderate carb intake to like VL, very low carb, you know, like he's trying to get down to 50 grams a day or 25 grams a day. Because my answer would be really different for each of those scenarios. But let's just assume for the sake of argument that it's somewhere in the middle, you know, that maybe he has a normal sort of average carb intake, 200 grams a day or something. And he's trying to get down to something like 100 or 125. Insomnia also, of course, is a really non-specific symptom, which means it can be caused by just so many different things. You know, all kinds of different physiological problems, emotional problems, you know, emotional shifts, psychological issues, stress, etc.
Symptoms of life.
Life, exactly. Insomnia caused by life. So in my experience, though, the way all of the symptoms of life play out is causing blood sugar imbalances and trashing our adrenals. Those are, from what I see, those are the two major causes of insomnia from a physiological perspective. Adrenal stress can be both the cause of and caused by blood sugar imbalances, and vice versa. So there's a really tight relationship between blood sugar and adrenal function. I mentioned before that our cells require a steady supply of glucose to function properly. And if blood sugar drops through the night, then cortisol will kick in, the stress hormone, and raise blood sugar back up to appropriate levels. But what can happen here is that it will overshoot the target and blood sugar will go a little bit higher than it needs to and can actually wake you up. Or if cortisol is low, because of chronic stress and there isn't enough cortisol to kick the blood sugar back up, then adrenaline, norepinephrine, and epinephrine will kick in to raise the blood sugar back up. And you can bet that if adrenaline's kicking in the middle of the night to get your blood sugar up, you're gonna that's when you wake up going, oh my God, my business or my taxes or, you know, whatever it is you wake up in the middle of the night being terrified of. That's, and your heart's, you know, beating out of your chest and stuff. That's can be an adrenaline surge. Another potential issue here is serotonin, which of course is the neurotransmitter and one of the neurotransmitters involved with regulating mood and producing feelings of well-being, and of course has a big impact on our sleep. So how does what we eat affect serotonin? Tryptophan, which is amino acid found in proteins, is a precursor to serotonin. And I just need another little drink of water here.
No problem. I personally noted that anytime I dropped carbs way too low, it usually gave me sleep disturbance. But I like the idea of the perfect health diet. I like having a good amount of like safe starches in the diet. I've noticed that personally kind of helps me get to bed all the time. I used to have, when I was on the standard American diet, I never got to sleep. I was up till all hours of the night.
I agree. I definitely think I'm not a big fan of zero carb or very low carb diets. We'll take that on maybe in the next show. But getting back to serotonin, we convert, you know, tryptophan gets converted to serotonin, but tryptophan requires the help of transport molecule to cross the blood-brain barrier, and there are several other amino acids from food that compete for those same transport molecules. So normally, if you eat carbohydrates or certain proteins, insulin gets released, and then insulin helps to clear out the amino acids that compete with tryptophan for transport molecules, you know, into the brain. But here's the catch. If somebody is insulin resistant, insulin won't be able to clear those other amino acids out as effectively, and then not as much serotonin gets made from the tryptophan that they eat in foods. So if somebody's been eating a standard American diet, high in processed and refined carbs, there's a pretty good chance they have some degree of insulin resistance, or they're hypoglycemic or reactive hypoglycemia. And then when they switch over to a low-carb diet, which would certainly benefit them over time and stabilize their blood sugar, the transition can be really rocky, and it can cause symptoms like insomnia or agitation related to blood sugar fluctuations and serotonin imbalance. So basically, when the body's used to burning carbs for energy, it just takes a while to switch the machinery over to burning fat. And things like L-carnitine can help. L-carnitine is responsible for transporting fat into the mitochondria where it's burned for energy. B6 and magnesium are needed for converting tryptophan into serotonin. And a lot of people are magnesium deficient, I'd say more than vitamin D. And you know, beyond that, this is where I need more information to know what to recommend. But I agree with you, Danny, that and of course with Paul and Xiaoqing from the Perfect Health Diet about their recommendation for keeping glucose intake at around 400 calories a day, or, you know, 100 grams a day from safe starch. I think that actually benefits people.
It seems like that's kind of coming around in the paleo circle. It seems like starches are, and potatoes in particular, are coming back in a big way ever since Don. I'm sorry, what's it? Matez,
I think, yeah.
Matez, he wrote that awesome Primal Potatoes article.
Yeah.
But I think that got everybody kind of out of the super low-carb zeitgeist like that everybody was kind of into.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there are times when low-carb diets can be beneficial and ketogenic diets can be beneficial. But for the average person, I don't think they're a great idea. And I've seen a lot of patients of mine have come into my practice doing, you know, almost zero carb diets and intermittent fasting, and they're plateaued on weight loss, or they're even gaining weight. I stopped the intermittent fasting, which I believe is beneficial for most people, but not for everybody. We'll talk about that later. And then I have them start eating more carbohydrate, which they think is crazy because they're trying to lose weight. In their mind, you know, carbohydrate equals getting fat. But as soon as they do that, almost all of them start to lose weight again, and they feel better too. So I think that's it. Did we make it through? It's amazing.
We stumbled through our first episode.
Impressive.
Cool. Okay, so that's going to bring us, obviously, the end of this week's episode. Chris, why don't you tell us everything that you are doing this week and how we can find your work on the internet?
Please don't make me tell you everything. I think we'd be here for another hour. I'm really excited about a seminar I've got coming up called Growing a Healthy Baby, Nutrition for Conception, Pregnancy, and Breastfeeding. And, you know, we're going to talk about all of what we know from looking at anthropological evidence and evolutionary medicine about, and combining that with what the modern clinical research suggests, is that a healthy diet, you know, for fertility and pregnancy. I'm offering that as a live seminar in Berkeley, the first time on the 13th. It's nearly sold out, which is pretty exciting.
Awesome.
And then I'm going to I'm going to package that content into like a 6-week online class, I think, so it can be accessible to people around the world. And I'm also considering turning it into a DVD, so that people even who can't, you know, manage to attend the class can get the information, because I think it's super important. Couple other things, big website redesign. I mentioned that in the beginning of the show, so look out for a brand new, polished up Healthy Skeptic site. There's going to be some good new functionality on there too. What else?
What's your Twitter, Chris?
Twitter is Chris Kresser. Come check us out on Facebook if you haven't already. We're getting close to 3,000 fans, which is awesome. It's the Healthy Skeptic. No, was it facebook.thehealthyskeptic.com? Is that right?
How do they do their URLs? I think it's facebook.com/thehealthyskeptic.
Well, I have this tricky redirect thing. The Healthy Skeptic. I really should have had this all together before we talked. Yeah, just go to facebook.com/thehealthyskeptic. I don't know.
If you type in the Healthy Skeptic in the search bar, yeah, it's like the first thing.
Anyways, the Facebook page is fun because I post, I take pictures of my food and put it up there. I do a lot of links to studies that never make it to my blogs. There's a big community of really engaged, smart. I learned a lot from all the people who post there, and it's really cool. I was a social media skeptic for a long time, and I still don't use it much personally, but I really am enjoying the Facebook page. So yeah, check us out. Come join us if you're not there already. That's all that comes to mind. I'm sure there's a lot more, but I've been so busy lately. My brain is a little bit scattered. So
no problem.
Pick it
no
up
problem.
Next week, next time.
Cool. Okay. You can find me at twitter.com/DannyRoddy, and my website is thehealthyhairdiet.com. Keep sending us your questions at both of Chris's sites, thehealthyskeptic.org and chriskresser.com, and his Facebook page. And thanks for listening, guys. We're super excited, and take care.
Thanks, everybody. Good good me talking, you listening. See you next time.